Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Europe's debt crisis has been on a long, slow burn. But lately, politicians and economists and bankers are getting downright spooked. One bank collapse, one unexpected event, and they fear the whole edifice could come crashing down and drag the world economy down with it. The Swiss are building a wall around their currency. U.S. Treasury Secretary Geithner flew to Europe this weekend to beg EU leaders to take action. But talk about glass houses. This hour on Point, the Euro crisis and what it means now for the global economy. You can join the conversation. Are you watching the slow motion meltdown over there? Do you trust Europe will get it together? How? And what if it doesn't? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining us now from Berlin is Nicholas Kulisch, Berlin Bureau Chief for the New York Times. Nick Kulisch, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
And from London, we're joined by Jan Randolph, Director of Sovereign Risk for the international consultancy group IHS Global Insight. Jan Randolph, thanks very much to you for being with us.
Very pleased to be with you.
Give us a sense of where this thing stands. We had a big meeting there in Poland. All kinds of people joined. Even Timothy Geithner was there, unprecedented. But is there any solution emerging to the default risk and problems Europe is staring at?
There's the default prospect. Greece is very close to running out of money. Some have indicated that around about the 10th of October. It's not too far away. On the other hand, the next bond repayment's not due till December, so the earliest they can default is December. Usually in this situation, it's really up to the creditors. They basically precipitate the default scenario by simply not providing the next slug of money. In this case, it would be from the bailout fund, which is one-third financed by the IMF and two-thirds financed by the Eurozone governments. And within that, the most important is the German government, Berlin. They have to make a decision whether to continue the wheel of finance to keep Greece afloat. But they're also asking themselves, is Greece doing enough? This is a crisis of deeds as much as words. Are they actually delivering on the promises they signed up for when the bailout was originally structured and designed for them? So they're looking, I think, ultimately, what's the litmus test for Berlin is the political resolve to implement. And I think that will be around privatization. So far, they haven't privatized one euro, and they're due something like $2.3 billion by the end of this month, September, and $5 billion by the end of December. And the reason why I think that is because the Germans themselves, if you remember when they assumed East Germany, they went through mass privatization of the state-owned Kombinate, the state-owned East German companies under the communist system. And that created a lot of social unease and unrest and difficulty. And they're basically saying, if we can do it, why should we not let – we're not going to let Greece off the hook.
So, Nick Kulisch, we talked with you a couple of months ago in Germany. The situation didn't look that different then. Jan reminds us the earliest they can default is December, but that doesn't look so far away. And some quite drastic consequences have been outlined here and there. How's German thinking on this evolving? Are they still digging in their heels and saying, no, Greece has to get its act together? Have they become more amenable to a deep and ongoing bailout? What's the direction, Nicholas?
I would say that it's turned into more of a fight here than it was before, that the grumbling has turned into shouting, the German government is actually made up of three parties, Angela Merkel's Christian Democrats, the Bavarian, they say, sister party, the Christian Social Union, and the Free Democrats. And the other two parties have really been making a stink and throwing around the term default and even talking about, you know, asking or forcing Greece to leave the euro. So it's definitely gotten – the tone has gotten rawer over here.
There's something going on, Jan Randolph, with central banks pooling money here. Now, that's not for sovereign debt. That's for European banks who are faced with difficulties because of the sovereign bank problem, debt problem with Greece and others?
Well, I think it's important to understand the sovereign debt problem is also a banking problem, because in Europe, most sovereign debt is held by domestic banks with some crossover into other core Eurozone banking systems, in the case of Ireland and Greece particularly, who are have been borrowing heavily from the French and Germans. So most debt in Europe is contained within Europe, unlike the US, of course. You know, we know the US owes a lot to China and Asia. That's not the case for Europe. So if, for example, we have a sovereign debt questions, particularly if the mark-to-market value is less than the original holding value, if you like, of these debts, then that implicates the banks, because the you know their collateral, their, you know, their, you know, the bonds are worth less mark-to-market, and that compromises their capital and raises questions about the solidity of the banks.
Nicholas Kulish, the suggestion is that we're back in a kind of 2007 posture here, except in Europe, not on Wall Street this time, that we could see something equivalent to a Lehman Brothers problem emerge, and emerge very quickly here. Is that what the Fed's doing here when it joins with these other central banks, Europe's, Japan's, in making more liquidity available? Are they trying to avoid a Lehman Brothers scenario?
Yeah, I mean, I think they definitely are. And I would say that that is some reason for optimism. I mean, I think that that there's now an awareness that these things can come up. And so they're less likely, I guess, to take us by surprise. But, you know, every time an agreement is reached, every time a step is taken, you know, it calms the markets briefly. And then the fundamental underlying problems, you know, facing these heavily indebted countries and the political difficulties facing the European Union on the one hand and Germany on the other sort of come back and it starts up all over again.
Jan, you've said we're at a shock event risk here right now. What kind of shock? What might it look like? And with what kind of consequences?
Well, it's really in the realms of Rumsfeld's unknown unknowns. I mean, we know the pressure on banks because they hold a lot of this sovereign debt. And we could get a contagion effect from a Greek situation where there's policy failure and there's a deliberate pulling of the plug. That could still yet happen. But it's the contagion that really concerns everyone. Banking is a bit like mountaineering. Everyone's roped up together. And more importantly, you may know who your counterparts are, but your counterparts also hold maybe linked to banks on the other side of the mountain you can't see. And so you assume most caution. And that's the problem, really. You know, the contagion effects, and we could yet see, for example, a bank wobbling that hasn't fully revealed, you know, its full exposures. And you know, banks often like to sit on their problems and not reveal them. So there is that possibility of a surprise that could start a chain reaction. So far, the authorities in Europe believe they've got things just about contained. You know, they're running very close to the edge. I mean, Greece is living on the edge here. And in some ways, that's deliberate. The pressure has always been kept on Greece to perform, to come up with, to deliver in terms of its privatization, to deliver in terms of raising taxes and cutting expenditure. And it's a difficult task for them when the recession's getting worse and worse. It's like going up a downhill escalator. And if you slow up, you end up where you started. And yet you have to get to the top to close your budget deficit. It's a bit like that for Greece. But, you know, the Berlin in particular and a lot of other governments in Europe are very, very careful about the Greek situation, because they know that Greece in the past has got a long history of missing targets, evading, coming up with excuses. And this is really a crisis of deed rather than a crisis of words.
Nick, there's talk again of credit default swaps. We saw how those went to work in the U.S. financial crisis a couple of years ago. These now backing up sovereign debt in Europe. And the question, as Jan alludes to, you don't know who exactly holds them. What is the possibility of this sort of roped line of mountaineers here on this sheer face lately slipping, falling, and that coming back into U.S. banks?
Well, I think that Jan put it well when he talked about the ropes together. I think we've seen over and over again that nothing can be contained to one side of the Atlantic or the other. That if the United States has a problem with its debt ceiling debate that sends markets here, our markets in the United States tumbling, that it'll affect Europe as well. And I think, you know, the same goes the other way around. That's why you see Timothy Geithner. I mean, I don't think he wanted to spend his weekend mind in Wrocław, Poland. He went there because he was extremely afraid that that the European situation could affect the American one. And we all know, I think, how delicate the U.S. economy is, probably already in the second half of a double dip recession.
Jan, what about that risk? If Europe slips, if Greece falls, if they get into a tumble, how does it go across the Atlantic?
Well, we are in a globalized world, and financial markets particularly are globalized. We saw that with Lehman Brothers. Now the ball's in the other courts, in the European court, and it could work the other way around. No troubles in Europe in the financial system will affect the U.S. financial system and have knock-on consequences for the economy. It's just working the other way around this time. Should that happen, of course. There is some point for optimism, though. I mean, the central bank certainly got together quite smartly, I think, earlier in the week, basically flooded European markets with dollar liquidity for those banks that needed dollar funding. So they certainly can keep things afloat. I personally think the European central bank's really got to step up a little bit more. In some ways, you know, its origins were that of the Bundesbank. The Germans, when they gave up the Deutsche Mark, had certain conditions. The European Central Bank had to be based in Frankfurt. Mm. More importantly, it had to be molded and influenced in the philosophy of German monetarism, and a clear separation of monetary policy from fiscal policy and absolute independence as far as you can get that. But, you know, really, you know, that kind of central bank, it's suited for a West German economy of the 60s and 70s, but it's very ill-suited to a Eurozone continental economy with different parts to it.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about whether Europe, the EU, is falling apart and what that question means there, here. We've been joined from Berlin by Nicholas Kulisch. He's Berlin bureau chief for the New York Times. From London by Jan Randolph at IHS Global Insight, director of sovereign risk there. And, of course, there's plenty of that in Europe right now. Joining us as well from Washington is Shehrazad Rahman. She's director of the European Union Research Center, professor at George Washington University, been an advisor to the World Bank, the IMF, central banks, finance ministers, you name it, author of European Economic and Monetary Union. Shehrazad Rahman, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
Markets opening today very unhappy about what's going on in Europe. How do you see what's happening in Europe right now?
Well, Tom, you know, we are all interconnected at this point. The game has gone far down the road. If Greece sneezes, we have a 600-point drop in the market. And every average American feels it in their pension funds, in their investment funds. And so that is the new reality. I think Europe has muddled through this mess for the last 18 months. And Timothy Geithner is right. They have to get their act together. Although it's almost the pot calling the kettle black. The U.S. has pretty much the same problems Europe has. We have political muddling. We can't seem to get our act together. And we have this basic oxymoronic kind of situation where in the short run, both sides of the continent need stimulus. And that means more spending, because if there's no growth, there's no economic growth, there are no jobs here, and there's no paying back the debt in Europe. In the long run, we all understand austerity cuts must be made, tax reforms must be had, and spending cuts must be made.
But what getting one's act together means today, of course, is so hotly debated. You know, Germany wants Greece to get in a very tight, laced-up jacket here. Greece is struggling with that. You say austerity is not the way to go, but that's exactly what Germany's asking for, isn't it?
Well, yes, and you know, and you can't blame them because they're footing a large portion of this bill. You know, there are two scenarios one can look at in Europe. And one is that, and this is a popular one, that the Mediterranean southern countries have simply spent too much. They basically had a party. And now what they need is a heck of a lot of austerity, and they need to tighten their budgets. And when they cut back, we'll have the problem solved. Now, that's one narrative. There's another narrative that we don't like to talk about too much, and that there was abject market failure here in Europe. The European markets and the global markets began to see the Eurozone as one entity, as risk-free government debt, that no countries would be allowed to default. Nothing would happen to Greece if they just kept borrowing and borrowing, and the markets viewed Greece in the same light as they viewed Germany in terms of giving them access to financing. And that's market failure.
So what does that mean? If there's market failure, the markets didn't see this coming. Is that fair? I mean, governments were certainly encouraging banks within their borders to stay in the game here. Presumably, they're not going to walk away from markets. How do you see this resolving itself, Shirazad?
Well, this is a difficult call. Europe embarked on a very ambitious project, this economic and monetary union, and a part of it has not been completed, which is now resulting in the crisis that we have, and that's the fiscal component of a monetary union. There has to be some kind of fiscal convergence, some kind of fiscal oversight, because to put it bluntly, these countries don't look alike, nor have the historic records of behaving in the same fashion for monetary and fiscal policies. We had hoped they would, and there would be no fiscal problems, but that was a lot to hope for. And we have seen now that they have to take the next step, and this is the final step to a monetary union. Unfortunately, the markets are not that patient. Revamping a treaty, especially the Treaty of Rome, to include fiscal austerity and fiscal oversight, is going to take years. And we don't have the time to wait for that. And so it leads to the dilemma that until there is a fiscal union, Eurozone members simply have no alternative but to coordinate amongst each other. And Germany is going to have to foot part of the bill, or most of the bill.
Nicholas, in Berlin, they're watching all this. It's been months since we talked last. I mean, you say think people are getting angrier there, more upset there. But what kind of scenario do they picture? Many people are talking about Greek default now as if it is inevitable.
Yeah, I mean, I think those people also have an argument. I guess it's a question of, you know, what one means by default, and you know, if you're talking about an orderly managed process in which Greek debt, you know, is restructured, some might argue it's already begun, but it's almost certainly on the way. I mean, I think that you start to get into the more irresponsible voices in Germany when people start moralizing about how Greece has to leave the euro. And I mean, you could debate the merits of leaving the euro or not, but there's very much a streak here of sort of what Shahrazad was referring to, which is this idea that those bad people were partying and those bad people need to be taught a lesson. And I don't think that's a helpful way forward for economic or political union.
Jan Randolph, paint the picture for us. What would it look like if Greece left the euro, the currency, and then what? I guess went back to the drachma, their old currency. How might that happen? What would it mean in Greece?
Well, I think it's very important for anyone who talks about euro collapse or breakaway of countries from the eurozone to actually explain in reasonable terms the cause and effect of this outside their imagination. Now, what is the process? If you take the EU treaty at the moment, there's no clause for a euro exit, so no country can push out another. Even if the German government wanted Greece to leave, they can't force this. On the other hand, a country might decide to leave, and it's always, always a political decision to join the euro and a political decision to leave. And even that is questionable on the EU treaty side, whether it's legal or not. But if let's pan out a realistic scenario, mm-hmm. possibility, okay. and then we can attach a probability to it, two different things. For example, if Greece fails to privatize 1 euro by the end of the year, even though it's promised five billion by the end of the year. Let's say its deficit gets wider because it's unable to collect those taxes or unwilling to collect those taxes. You know, it can turn around come with all sorts of arguments, but Berlin may throw in the towel. Basically, it says we're not prepared to co-fund this bailout. We will not give them the next tranche or slug of money from the bailout. And that means basically they're pulling the plug. Greece would already have run out of money by sometime in the middle of October, mm-hmm. And can only finance by further cuts. So it basically there's no financing going into Greece. There's no money coming in from the bailout. The markets have left long time ago in terms of financing the debt, except for a small portion of domestic financing at Treasury level, but it's very, very small. And the European Central Bank may decide to pull its liquidity lines that are keeping the Greek banks afloat. So there's not one new euro going into Greece. What happens then? The next day, the budget deficit has to close, and that means the country collapses onto a cash basis only. They can only import after they've exported something. They can only pay state salaries, teachers, doctors, nurses, armed forces, to the extent they've got money coming in on the tax side.
Are they still using the euro in this scenario, Jan, or
yes,
not?
Basically.
But there's new ones coming in.
Absolutely. Well, they're cut adrift, basically. Mm-hmm. And it's a bit like Zimbabwe when the banks close down their country limits. There's no credit from the outside, no credit from the coming in to finance that deficit. So it has to close. But in the process of closing, the economy collapses another 20-30% onto a cash basis, and unemployment shoots up. You know, overnight, you can't pay 20% of your teachers. Overnight, you can't pay 15% of your armed forces, and so on and so on. And then there'll be a mass run on the banks because no one wants to hold, the banks are in a state of collapse. There'll be a bank run. What the state then has to do is forcibly nationalize the deposit base into drachma if it wants to sort of rescue the banking system. So, you know,
just start printing its own currency again, just walk absolutely away from the euro.
Introduce its own credit system based around the drachma. If it can't get euros lent to it, it will create its own credit fiat currency called the drachma, and it will pay all its state salaries overnight the next day in drachma. And so you have a little bit of a resuscitation of the economy from its state of collapse. But basically, it's cut adrift. You know, it still uses euros. Like some countries still use euros, even though they're not officially members of the eurozone. For example, Andorra, Kosovo, Montenegro, they're all tied to the euro, but they're not actually official members. But they use this in circulation, a bit like some countries use dollars. You know, Ecuador is a dollarized economy, even though the dollar supply only comes from the balance of payments. It's not provided by the U.S. Fed.
Right, but there's the scenario where it actually just falls out effectively of the eurozone. I want to, Shirazad, Nicholas, let me take that to you. Nicholas, first to you in Germany. Germans must be thinking this through. Is that all right with Germany? What are the knock-on effects of that? What does it mean for the European economy, to start with, Nicholas?
Well, I mean, I think that there's sort of a throw them overboard crowd, and they just seem to think that we need cut our losses. Rather than spend hundreds of billions of dollars on bailouts, we can just use a fraction of that to shore up our own banks, and we can sort of it's almost like amputation, you might say. And then I think that the cautious crowd in the middle, led by Chancellor Merkel, are those who say, we have seen some wild market gyrations over tiny, tiny news, and this is an utterly unpredictable, unprecedented situation. We have no idea what would happen in the process of unwinding, this. And so we just need to keep sort of kicking the ball downfield until the problem goes away. And then, of course, there's a third camp, and that would be the people who believe, yes, we have to go all the way to fiscal union, we have to have euro bonds, we have to have a permanent solution that keeps all the countries in the euro. And so you kind of have these three camps, basically. But I don't think anyone really can tell you what would happen if a country left the euro suddenly.
Shirazad Rahman, project your mind into that scenario. If it's a hard landing into the drachma for Greece when it's, by the end of the year here, then what?
Well, I think that the Greeks will go kicking and screaming out of the eurozone, because once they leave, they will be condemned into the dark ages for decades, because they cannot introduce another currency that would be valid in the world's markets, and especially not against the euro. I think that if they go in line with the default, if the Germans decide, all right, no more payments. I think before the scenario that was mentioned earlier, mm-hmm. I believe the IMF, Christine Lagarde, would probably step in and buy them a little more time. But once this happens, once this issue for default happens, I think our eyes are no longer going to be on Greece. Our eyes are going to be on the other countries, which are going to cause a heck of a lot more chaos in the world, and that's going to be Italy. We've got two basic fundamental problems in Europe today. One is they have to recapitalize their banks. They're severely inadequately capitalized, and if that doesn't happen, the problem is not going to go away. And the other problem is the loss of confidence in sovereign bonds in certain eurozone countries, especially the southern countries. And this has to be resolved. And if this isn't resolved, you know, we're headed to more market volatility. I don't blame the markets. There's a lot of uncertainty. European leadership has been awful in terms of crisis management. This is new territory for them. They don't know what to do. And at some point, if Greece does go towards a default, I think there'll be American pressure with the IMF to buy more time, because it will affect us directly here in the markets.
But there's been a lot of time already, and people say you just can't put this off forever. At some point, it comes to a head. Where's the solution? There's a lot of kind of soft talk about more time and buying and all that shares out, but is China going to come in and save the day here? Brazil? The United States, with all its problems? How do you recapitalize the banks? How do you put things on a footing for more confidence in sovereign debt?
You know, they're going to have to basically cough up the money. In terms of keeping Greece, Germany, France, they have to do it. The other thing that can be done is that they can spend more money in their own economies and jumpstart, you know, flat growth, which is what is happening in Germany and France across most of the European countries that are doing relatively well.
They're jumpstarting growth, or
they have to by spending, and nobody's doing it. Mm-hmm. That's the only way to go. If there is no jumpstarting the economy, there is no growth. There is no hope for the rest of Europe to be pulled up in terms of future economic growth, and no hope to pay this back. Look, if you're an investor, whether you're Chinese or Brazilian, would you invest in Italian bonds? You're not sure how this thing is going to be resolved. Why on earth would you invest in them? And so I think that unless that panic is stopped and addressed by recapitalizing banks and building confidence in sovereign bonds, and I have no idea how you can do that for bonds in Spain and Greece and Ireland, this problem is going to continue.
Can't go on, must go on, must be fixed, can't be fixed. Nicholas in Suwannee, Tennessee. Thanks for calling, Nicholas. You're on the air with Nick Kulish, Jan Randolph, and Shehrazad Rahman. Hi, Nick.
Hi, Tom. I think my question fits in with everything that you're talking about. I'm not excluding Asia and China. I'm not suggesting that we have a world economy connected. But is this not an appropriate time when America is having the exact same problem as Europe for everyone to sit down at a table together and figure out how to solve these problems together? Since we may be having them different, and maybe Greece is having theirs immediately, but we're all kind of in the same boat.
Well, yes and no. Some have big surpluses. Some have big deficits. Clearly, lots of mutual dependence. Shehrazad, can you imagine that? Nicholas wants, you know, a sort of big sit-down restructuring of the global economy.
Oh, you know, that would be wonderful, but I just can't imagine that. We can't even get our own house in order here in the United States. We had a debt ceiling debacle, which downgraded the United States. It was avoidable. We knew it was avoidable, but we couldn't manage to get our political muddling together. And the Europeans have exactly the same problem on a bigger scale over there.
So, Jan Randolph, is this just the West sort of going down the river here? A listener says online, the developed world is being devoured by the developing world. This is part of it. Folks at the top have sold the middle and working classes down the river. Is there a restructuring going on, whether or not it's around a nice conference table, Jan?
Well, I think the debt challenges are common in the West. Japan's got its own version, mm-hmm. America's got its version, and Europe has its own version. So, debt you know is a big challenge, particularly in a low growth, slow growth, no growth environment, which is also true for Europe. Now, I mean, Germany had been the locomotive, pulling others up around it until recently, too slowing sharply now. And that's part of a global growth slowdown. So the debt challenges have become even more difficult, you know, as we go up this escalator that's actually taking us down. Yes, I mean, it's a real challenge. And I think there are certain things we have to do to get at it for the European side. And one is ECB, fiscal union, but also ultimately we have to look where growth is going to come from.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the trouble in Europe. It's been growing and growing for a long time. It's getting really acute. Timothy Geithner headed across the Atlantic at the end of last week to try and put an oar in there. Mixed reception for him, but no solution in sight yet that people are willing and ready to sign on for to the trouble in Europe. Nicholas Kulish, Berlin bureau chief for the New York Times, is with us. Jan Randolph is here from London with IHS Global Insight. And from Washington, Shehrazad Rahman is here, director of the European Union Research Center at George Washington and a professor at George Washington University. Let's go to our listeners, Laura in Manchester, Massachusetts. Laura, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I think that Germany owes Greece for how it beat her down during World War II. And after World War II, Germany benefited by the Lend-Lease program, and that was a form of forgiveness of them. And I think that the unforgiveness of Germany after World War I resulted in a world depression. So I think that right now all the countries should stop the self-righteous niggling over financial trends and tendencies and think of world justice in its treatment of other countries.
Laura, I will pick that up with our panel, but let me just ask you, does Germany owe Greece even after Greece has been so spendthrift, apparently, even after Greece lied about its national finances, does Germany still owe Greece in that circumstance?
Yes.
Nicholas Kulisch, how's that message go down in Berlin?
I don't think that message goes down too well here. I think, although, I mean, I would almost want to appeal to Jan or Sherazade to ask, but I get the impression, you know, Germany is not a country that has that little debt. I mean, it has its yearly budget deficits under control, but I'd really kind of wonder if they assumed all of the debt from Greece and Italy and Spain, you know, that other countries, you know, that, or that investors are worried about. I feel like we would then say, oh my God, Germany can't afford its debt anymore. I wonder if this country, which already, you know, since the fall of the Berlin Wall has, you know, shouldered the rebuilding of East Germany from almost nothing and shouldered also the rebuilding of Western and Southern Europe and Eastern Europe as the largest net contributor to the European Union's funds, if this country could really afford to do everything that people ask of it.
Jan Randolph, I wonder how you see German politics. You've got some German background yourself. I mean, our caller says Germany owes Greece ever since World War II, but I think you've been worrying a bit about Germany actually sliding back towards some of those very aggressive political posture and outlook on the world that helped take us to World War II, Jan.
Yeah, so if you look since the Second World War, West Germany had always been the obliging power. It was effectively bankrolling every new expansion of the European Union. And it was prepared to do that while it was, you know, emerging from the ashes of the Second World War. You know, it was obliging on its Ostpolitik, obliging to the US and its demands, joining NATO. But things had changed once they had unification. They got what they wanted, a reunified Germany. And then they realized, well, working the war guilt has gone too far. You know, we want to be a more normal power like France or the UK or even the US. And that worries everyone because they're no longer this so-called reliable partner anymore. They're always falling into line. I mean, they made a different decision about Libya, for example. Having said that, though, I mean, no country in Europe has benefited more from the peace and stability in Europe than Germany itself. It's prospered on that. It's got the stability it's always craved. It's one of the highest German values, Ordnung, order and stability, and they want to spread this culture of stability around Europe. On the debt side, it's true that German debt is public debt is something like 60-70% of GDP, and it's, you know, it's significant. But take the economy overall, and it's a huge structural exporter, a bit like Japan, and it's got very high savings. There's very little private debt compared to the US or the Anglo-Saxon economies or even now Spain. So, you know, it's a very wealthy economy. And one can ask, you know, it is in a position. Overall, if you look at the public and private side, it is a huge net creditor country. It is in a position more than others to stimulate one way or another. The bond markets have decided already who their safe havens are.
But what about the politics, Jan? I mean, you've talked about Northern Europe, i.e. maybe Germany, developing its own Tea Party movement or something even tougher.
It's a very difficult position for a German chancellor to be in. The room is narrowing both on the left and right in a sense that there are those in her coalition, the Free Democrats, the smaller party coalition members, they feel that she's gone too far in creating, you know, in supporting the new central fund, the EFSF facility. And she thinks she's gone too, they think she's gone too far in support and giving license to others to be profligate. And then there's others say that she's not European enough, you know, and she's at risk squandering all that political capital that's been put into the Eurozone and European project over the decades, and she's in a position now to squander all that and make some huge mistakes. So her room for manoeuvre is getting less and less, and she's losing her Land elections, these large counties. It's a very federal system. These states, you know, she's been losing six or seven in a row now, including Berlin recently, last weekend. And so, you know, she's in a very, very difficult position. No, I think her main problem, though, is selling to the German public the importance of Europe and the euro to Germany. Its prosperity is inextricably linked to this, and it needs to show some enlightened self-interest for Germany's own enlightenment, in the same way the U.S. showed enlightened self-interest at the end of the Second World War. It was in a position to do something while Europe was devastated after war. It, through the Marshall Plan, saw a fantastic resurrection of Western European economies, including the UK. It wasn't just Germany. Mm. And, you know, Germany should show the same kind of enlightened self-interest now, I think.
Shehzad Rahman, selling it all over again, it looks like such a big problem, and doing it under this pressure. I mean, you've talked about what we may be seeing here, a decade or more, a very, very tough economy. That has implications not just for standards of living, but for politics, for the functioning of democracy itself, Shehrazad.
I think you're absolutely right. I think that we are headed towards a lost decade on both sides of the Atlantic. The worst of the euro crisis is yet to come. I think most of us are fully aware of it. Having said all of that, at the end of the day, I'd much rather be the United States than be the European Eurozone right at this point, especially when you look at the debt. You know, yes, we have high debt, but our debt, you know, is partly structural but partly event-driven. We had two very large wars and a financial crisis that doubled our debt literally, you know, within mm-hmm. a very short
amount
of time.
Less than a decade. Mm-hmm.
That's absolutely right. And I think that we have the means and the money to pay this back. We just have to get the political will, which is a tall order at this particular junction, especially until after the elections. But we can pay it back. The Eurozone countries, especially some of them, have a very different problem. They have a classical economic developing country problem. They borrow too much and they simply don't have the money to pay it back. And hence comes, you know, countries like Germany and France having to bail them out.
Nicholas,
but I want to add one thing. Mm-hmm. I think that one has to be a little bit careful. I am an economic history buff, and I mm-hmm. believe that if you don't look back in time and look at history, you're doomed to repeat the mistakes. But I am also an international finance person mm-hmm. who believes in the pragmatism of the new markets. And the reality is this, that, you know, Germany gave up a very, very strong currency for its commitment for the future of Europe. Mm-hmm. And unless we have a stable Germany today, the rest of the Eurozone's going down the tube.
But is there a question about having a stable Germany now? I mean, that's the one thing that seems stable here.
Stable in terms of having growth. German growth has to happen if the Eurozone is going to move forward. If Germany stays flat in its growth, and it very well might be if, you know, more and more monies are funneled into countries like Greece. And I'm not saying they shouldn't do it.
Yeah.
Just the question for Angela Merkel is, how long can she do it for?
Nicholas Kulisch, do you see German public, political leaders of a mind to provide a Marshall Plan to the rest of Europe? And can they afford to do it and still be the growth engine?
Well, I think that the problem that you've seen is that Angela Merkel is a leader who likes to take incremental steps. She's not a fan of the grand gesture. And I think that the idea of her with the current public opinion being what it is, launching a new German-led Marshall Plan for Europe is highly unlikely, I would say, to say the least.
Mm-hmm.
you also, I mean, you have to think too about, I mean, the German people are different. You know, I mean, Jan mentioned order and stability, but they, you know, they think about things like an independent central bank and, you know, a reliable currency. I mean, in a way that I don't think that Americans really do. You know, my grandmother is German and can remember the wheelbarrows full of money.
In inflation days, pre-war Germany.
Exactly, the Weimar hyperinflation. And so, I mean, I think that for, you know, for Germans, this is really important. And I know some very, very senior, you know, German politicians who were absolutely convinced in 2008 that we were months away from hyperinflation. Actually, you would see melting euros on the cover of major magazines because they were just they're really almost paranoid about it, I would say. So the way that they, you know, we have to, you know, we take into account, you know, often that other people from other cultures think differently, but you know, the Germans may look like a lot of Americans, but they think very differently.
Sherazad, there's a lively debate going on our Facebook page right now, On Point Radio, with some listeners saying, you know, hey, Well, let me give you a flavor of it. Here's Ashwin says, is anyone else seeing the poetic justice as the ex-imperialists are having comeuppance delivered to them? Saeed says, enjoying their demise. Is the continent solely responsible for raping, enslaving, dividing the lives of millions around the world? They're getting what they deserve after centuries of colonizing and plundering. Eric says, to take pleasure in the European decline is ridiculous. We'll have nothing but devastating effect on the whole world economy. Can anyone say powder keg? What do you say to that back and forth, Sherazad?
Well, I think I agree with the last caller that you just mentioned. You know, it's one thing to talk like that. It's another thing when it really hits your own pocketbooks. If there is a slow growth in Germany and the rest of the Eurozone does melt, which I don't see it happening completely, you'll see a direct impact on the U.S. markets, on the middle class in the United States. These 300, 600 drops in the markets, you know, middle-class America is taking real hits every night when they go to bed in their portfolios and in their retirement funds.
But on the other side of the debate we're seeing there, you've got people saying, hey, let the developing world have its day. Europe had it for centuries. It's time for turnabout.
And I think no one's saying the developing world shouldn't or the emerging markets shouldn't have their day, but we are interconnected. China's growth depends on its trade with us, with Europe. If we slow down, they slow down.
Chris in New Haven, Connecticut. Thanks for calling, Chris. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom. I'm glad the conversation has turned a little bit to the United States because Christine Lagrange is a big fan of an IMF bailout, probably to help the French banks. And I think Germany is going to schlump as much of this problem as they can onto the IMF. But there's been very little discussion in the news about the fact that 22, I think, or 23% of the IMF funds come from the United States. And when American voters begin to understand the amount of money they're going to be contributing to a European bailout, I think they're going to be very upset.
Well,
they're upset about bailing out their own economy.
Yeah, let alone yours. Let us look at that, Chris, and I'm glad for your call. There's another comment, Jan Randolph, online saying, you know, the IMF is one avenue here. This one says, Geithner helping to bail out European banks, bailout 2.0. Are you kidding me? Let them fail. What about the American role as this unfolds? How much exposure do you imagine the U.S. taxpayers will have, Jan?
Well, I think, you know, the origins of the IMF was born at the end of the Second World War. The Americans wanted it. They knew that this was enlightened self-interest to get things going again globally. If, you know, a healthy, recovering Europe was good for America. I mean, America could export back to a growing Europe. And if the IMF was instrumental in achieving that, everyone wins. It was a win-win situation.
And now?
And now it's the same sort of thing. I mean, you know, it's easy for you over in the States to say, we'll just let the Europeans fester in their own mess. Why should the IMF get involved with, you know, American money? Well, the fact is, if you're European Union as a GDP is the same size as the United States, and we have the equivalent of $9 trillion worth of consumption, consumer household purchasing power. It's the same size as the United States. And if it fails in Europe, we're talking about the equivalent of a failure of the U.S. And we are in this interconnected world. And it is good that the developing countries are developing. They provide a new source of demand. They've basically lifted Japan and Germany out of recession. Germany, the only economy that's fully recovered, really, since the financial crisis. And it's all due to the fact that they're good exporting back to these emerging markets.
Still, we've got our own tough times in the U.S. right now. I mean, how much of this could fall on American shoulders to pull out?
It's always, you know, the history of financial crises, if it involves solvency, how are the losses are going to be distributed across the taxpayer, across the banks, across the households? It's always a difficult political question, but it will always end up like this. Ultimately, it's politics that decides how the losses will fall so we can all move on. And with same sort of situation in the United States, you know, it was John Maynard Keynes, the great British economist in the 30s, that saw that, you know, in a world of global imbalances, i.e. countries with structural exporters like Germany and China, they create problems for others ultimately. You know, the debts will build up either on the private side or in the public side. And eventually, if you run this several years, you get a solvency crisis. We're right in the middle of one in Europe, and we're yet to figure out how the losses are going to be apportioned and how we're going to get out of it.
Nicholas, you just got half a minute here. Is this, at some level, a game of chicken between the U.S. and Germany? Who's going to do the bailing out here, or not that dynamic, Nick?
No, I wouldn't say that it's a game of chicken. I mean, I think that everyone understands the risks involved. It's just nobody quite knows how to get it done.
And the time grows short, Shahrazad. Do you see some, like, grand solution here, or are we just in for this bad decade that you're fearing?
I think fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy ride on both sides of the continent for the next year.
The next year, and maybe more. Shahrazad Rahman at the European Research Center in Washington, D.C., professor at George Washington University, author of European Economic and Monetary Union. Thanks for being with us again today, Shahrazad. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Jan Randolph at IHS Global Insight in London, thank you very much for your insights today.
Thank you.
And Nicholas Kulish, Berlin, Bureau Chief for the New York Times. Nick, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Tom. Pleasure.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.